You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
Tonight on The Atomic Show, we are interviewing or having a chat with Ruth Sponsler, who is a blogger, the author of the We Support Lee blog, and a mineral prospector, and all-around great lady. And we invited Ruth on the show tonight to try to get a few more voices into the conversation. As you all know, Shane and I are... You've heard us talk. We're both atomic geeks, but there's lots of other folks in the world, particularly in the blogosphere, that are supportive of the idea that nuclear power is a viable alternative to current energy supplies. And Ruth is one of those people.
So I guess I might start with a question for you, Ruth. Where does the title of your blog come from, and who is Lee?
Okay, Lee is the name of a possible proposed facility that Duke Power is thinking of submitting a construction and operation license for late in 07, I believe it is.
Okay. Because I looked all over the blog, the We Support Lee blog, and also the blog that you maintain. I think it's a separate one on Blogspot, and I could not find any information about it. Looking for any posts concerning where the title of the blog came from, it was a little mysterious. So
Ruth, do you live close to where the Lee power plant would be located?
I live about 105 or 110 miles, essentially north of it.
Okay.
And up the hill.
Up the hill.
Up the hill.
Yes, I live in the mountains of western North Carolina, actually in a very beautiful location called Yancey County, which is next to a place called Mitchell County.
Interesting.
And by the way, if my voice sounds a little bit rough, it's because I'm just getting over a cold.
Take your time. We're all recovering from colds or getting over colds. My wife just got over.
Oh, well, bless your heart. Bless your heart.
Yeah, it's funny. It's my wife's. She has a family who actually live in western North Carolina. I can't remember the name of the town now, but. Most of our family is down on the coast in Mississippi Gulf Coast. Both her family.
Oh my goodness, on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. Because between 1994 and 2001, I actually lived in Gulfport, Mississippi, and I was fortunate enough to have the foresight to move away from there 4 years and a month before Katrina hit.
You must have known that global warming was happening.
I was aware of it, yes. I had been I'd been on the computer looking at some material, not so specifically about that or about nuclear energy, but I did come across some websites concerning global warming. I was also aware of... the fact that I think it was in April 2001, unfortunately, the U.S. basically refused to sign on to Kyoto, the Kyoto Protocol. I was also aware that France and Japan were two countries that are key proponents of the Kyoto Protocol, and certainly was aware of how they derived most of, France derives most of its electricity, and how Japan derives quite a large portion.
So, Ruth, tell me, what makes you such a big supporter of nuclear energy? Do you work for the nuclear power industry?
No, I don't, actually, no. I'm a mineral collector. I really enjoy collecting minerals, and I have enjoyed doing this for quite a number of years. There's also just a little bit of a family background here. My mother was a technical secretary at the University of Chicago during the very early 1950s. She worked for a chemistry researcher, a physical chemist named Philip Harkins, and the chemistry building in Chicago, at the University of Chicago, is right next to the physics building. And when I was a child, she would tell me about having been acquainted with Enrico Fermi, Leo Szilard, Harold Urey, and some other very well-known names in physics.
Now, I think you told me in one exchange that we had that Leo Szilard had an interesting nickname.
Yeah, my mom told me that they called him Leo the Lizard.
I hope that wasn't for any particular behavioral attributes, but
no. My mother said that she got along well with him and liked his temperament. And no, I think it was just a little pun on his last name, just kind of reversing some of the letters.
So
he was the neat guy.
One of the stories I love about Leo Szilard was how he loved to take long baths, and that's where he did a lot of his thinking, and apparently that's where he developed his ideas for the first fission reactor, which he patented, of course, long before any fission reactors ever got built.
That's fascinating.
He also had a patent for a refrigeration cycle with Albert Einstein in the early 30s. It's a little-known fact.
So, Ruth, tell me, what kind of minerals do you collect in Western North Carolina?
Well, the mountains in Western North Carolina, first of all, they're home to what are known as pegmatites. And these are essentially granite that has cooled very slowly over geological time and thus has large grains. There are quartz, feldspar, and mica mines in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And then a few miles down the road, there are also some corundum and aluminum deposits, ruby deposits. However, closer to where I live, the majority minerals, of course, are quartz, feldspar, muscovite. However, there are some very interesting rare earth accessory minerals that are within the deposits. And among the minerals that are present are columbite, which is a mineral of niobium tantalum. And then there's samarskite, which is a multiple rare earth oxide. And there's also one or two uraninite deposits. And there are some places that one can find secondary uranium minerals as well.
So do you know if they've ever done any uranium mining in that area of North Carolina? Or are the deposits too dispersed?
From the literature that I've read, the localities, a couple of localities are Dana localities. So they have been known about for years and years. However, during the 1950s, when the uranium boom was happening out west, I don't really know of any prospecting or mining per se in the area. although I have talked to one or two old timers, and one lady mentioned to me, a lady about 80 years old, mentioned to me that quite a number of years ago, some people had visited a deposit on a hill behind her house looking for uranium. And a couple of my friends and I went up there with counters, and we indeed did find a small amount of a few rare earth minerals. We didn't find any uraninite, but we did find some arsenite and some monazite.
Monazite is a mineral that's associated with thorium, isn't it?
Monazite, yes. Monazite is a thorium mineral, yes, indeed. And in fact, another friend of mine has just recently done an analysis of some samples that we collected, and he confirmed that one of the specimens was monazite. So in this area, we actually have the occurrence of both uranium and thorium minerals.
Interesting.
I've heard of beach sand and placer deposits in North Carolina having monazite, but I didn't know that there were actual original monazite outcroppings in the bedrock. I thought that it was all eroded.
Well, it's not an outcropping per se in the bedrock. Actually, what it is, these deposits are in tailings dumps of pegmatite mines. And what the old-time miners did when they were looking pretty much for mica back during the 1940s and early 1950s for use in radio tubes and other such equipment would be they would blast out the pegmatite, which is the large-grained granite, and then they would leave mine tailings dumps. And it's basically just a great big pile of rock cobbles. And one basically goes there, looks through them. You can there's one site where I've even located specimens looking visually. Most sites, however, I need to use a Ludlum Model 19 in order to do my looking, and then I will locate a specimen, and then I will dig it up using a pole, essentially.
Is that Model 19 a Geiger counter or a scintillation counter?
It is a sodium iodide scintillation counter with a 1x1 crystal. In fact, on the internet, if you go to ludlums.com, you can get a spec sheet on the Ludlum Model 19.
So that's how you find your minerals or your radioactive isotopes, by using a scintillation detector?
Yes. Now, the Ludlum Model 19 is portable. I'm holding it in my hand right now, and it weighs a few pounds, but it's about the size of a child's lunchbox. Not much bigger than that, and it's also ruggedized and weatherized so that I can take it into a area that has a fair amount of grit and dirt and sand and that kind of thing, and take it there, use it for what I need to use it for, and then take it back home and just do a very small amount of cleaning and not have any problems.
That's great. Apparently, though, it doesn't protect you from poison ivy.
No, it doesn't. yeah, that's one little incident I had back at the end of April. Was I was at a site that's called the Fanny Gouge site. And this is actually a relatively low-lying, flat spot where most of the tailings have actually been removed a number of years ago, but there are a few specimens remaining, and the site is very heavily overgrown with vegetation and just general, you know, furred over with ground cover, basically. And so at the end of April, I went out there and decided to do a little digging, and I recovered a nice 1 centimeter by a 1 centimeter uraninite specimen, but about a day later, on my hands, I could tell there was something wrong. And, yeah, I had indeed run into some poison ivy.
And I got to tell you, the reason I brought that up was because I was reviewing some of the photos on the site that you'd shared with me several months ago. And I took one quick look at your hand, and I said, my goodness, you must have found a really intense specimen there.
That was actually probably, I was digging amongst some plant roots. And from what I've heard, the roots of poison ivy have the highest amount of the urushiol, which is the compound that irritates quite a large number of people's skin. I am fortunate to say that since that happened, it hasn't happened again all summer, although I've definitely gone out and done some digging for specimens.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So I want to get back a little bit to your efforts on your blog in trying to share as much information as you can find, apparently, about certain aspects of nuclear energy and the politics around it. I think one of the recent things that you've talked about is some efforts in Chapel Hill.
Yes. This is kind of unfortunate because there are a couple of pressure groups active in North Carolina, and they are trying to put pressure on the Sharon Harris facility that's operated by Progress Energy. And I actually I decided to take a gander and go down to the Chapel Hill City Council meeting. And what I found was really interesting. I would like to point the listeners over to a series of posts that actually appeared in NEI Nuclear Notes, the blog, last week regarding Helen Caldicott and regarding some of the tactics that the observers have seen used at her speaking engagements and that sort of thing. Because I when I went to the city council meeting in Chapel Hill, in all honesty, I observed some hard sell techniques being used by the anti-nuclear activists.
Can you describe some of these techniques?
Well, for example, the anti-nuclear activists made a presentation to the Chapel Hill City Council around the 22nd of last month. And apparently, they, you know, the city council did not hear the other side. And so the city council sort of rushed a proposed resolution onto its agenda, sort of at the last minute, with, you know, just a few days before the meeting. Then, when I was actually at the meeting, the city council and the activists sort of talked like they might be considering postponing the city council's vote on that resolution until a public forum would be held at which both the anti-nuclear activists and a representative for Progress Energy would be invited to speak. So those of us in the audience were sort of under the impression that the city council would postpone the vote for a little bit. But it turns out that did not happen at all, and the city council went ahead and voted on the matter anyway. And the discussion of postponement was just kind of, you know, it was a little bit of a deceptive thing. That's just what I think.
Ruth, what was the result of the vote, and what was the specific topic that they were voting on?
The topic that they were voting on was essentially a resolution that was pretty much proposed by a couple of anti-nuclear activist groups, they want to demand that Sharon Harris close down until it amends some fire protection facilities and equipment. And I must say that I really am not qualified to talk about this because I do not know all the details, but I do know that they are operating within the full limit of the NRC regulations. And if you follow those pieces on the blog, actually on one of the posts I've linked to the NRC report on Sharon Harris, and it's completely kosher, as I say.
Did the activist accept or listen to any comments about what would happen if Sharon Harris was to shut down? What would be the replacement power?
This topic was actually only brought up very briefly at the meeting, and I actually did speak on that topic very briefly. The council was quite strict about limiting me to just my 3 minutes, but I tried to speak on the topic, but unfortunately, one of the weaknesses is that other than the gentleman who represented Progress Energy, I was the only pro-nuclear speaker at the meeting. There was one major anti-nuclear activist speaker, and then there was another member who spoke briefly at the meeting. There were not a whole lot of speakers at the meeting, but unfortunately, we didn't really have the opportunity, like I would have wanted to have seen, to get that topic out in front at the meeting. Now, there was one clause in that proposed resolution that said they're not demanding it be closed until the next scheduled outage. But still in all, it's I feel that it's an attempt by these activists to pressure local city governments, actually out of the county where the plant is located, to meddle in the, you know, in the affairs of other counties and in the affairs of business.
So it's not even in the same county?
No. Chapel Hill is in Orange County, and the Sharon Harris Power Plant is in Southern Wake County. So it's actually in the adjoining county.
How far away from Chapel Hill is the plant?
If I remember right, and I could be off by several miles, it's somewhere 10 to 15 miles away.
Okay. Of course, it was kind of disheartening to me when I read your post because, you know, I always think of Chapel Hill as one of the concentrations of an educated population, and it was disheartening to me that folks there are as misinformed as your post indicated.
Unfortunately, a big part of it is the fact that Chapel Hill is not North Carolina's engineering school. The majority of engineering in North Carolina is at NC State.
Yeah, you know, it's I'm an English major by a undergraduate degree, and it always bothers me how difficult it is sometimes to speak to people who should listen to the message of a power source that is clean enough to run inside a submarine as something worth discussing. But I think the biggest problem I have is that most of them really don't like to do any kind of math at all. And so when I say, well, you know, nuclear power is clean, they say, well, so are wind and solar, and we'll just use those instead. And, of course, it's only when you do math that it, you know, starts to answer the question why wind and solar can't work to supply the kind of...
You're exactly right. And the math that's needed is nothing even close to calculus or advanced statistics. It's just simple arithmetic and the ability to read a graph or a chart. And I've presented a number of these charts on my website, and the charts are for European countries. And I like to use comparisons of European countries because conservation is better practice. In Europe, they are more conservation-minded, so they have factored out perhaps a little bit of wastefulness in that manner. The other thing about energy use in Europe is that the population lives closer together, and so people use more public transport. And that's the reason I like to compare the European countries. But, for example, Denmark actually is the country that has the largest renewable energy infrastructure, which is the Danish wind grid. And they really have been trying. They really have been installing a great deal of wind energy facilities. However, if you look at a plot of the overall energy use picture, even with Europe's largest wind grid, the vast majority of Denmark's energy is generated by fossil fuel, and in fact, a large proportion is generated by coal. One of the reasons is that Denmark is a flat country and thus has no hydroelectric resources. The countries in Europe that have the lowest carbon intensity, in other words, that means they are the closest to meeting Kyoto Protocol goals regarding carbon emissions, are in fact France, Sweden, Switzerland, Norway, and perhaps a couple others. And basically what the picture in those countries is in the Scandinavian countries, there's a large use of hydroelectric energy. In fact, in Norway, it's 100% hydroelectric. In Sweden, they have a base of hydroelectric energy, but then they have nuclear energy accounting for about 40% of their use. In Switzerland, it's a similar picture. They have hydroelectric, and then they have nuclear facilities. In France, as is very well known, they generate 79% of electricity with nuclear energy, and their carbon emissions are very low per capita or per $2,000 of gross domestic product. Now, what's interesting is to contrast the carbon intensity in those countries with the carbon intensity in European countries that have official anti-nuclear policies. And the most marked example of that would be Italy, which had a referendum during the late 1980s after the Chernobyl accident to close its nuclear power plants. What happened after that is that the Italy's imports of natural gas and oil for electricity generation went up markedly. And I have a chart that's linked at the site that from the International Energy Agency that shows this. And in fact, you can see the time frame in which the nuclear facilities were closed. And so the mantra of conservation did not work in Italy. Italy, in fact, actually imports both natural gas and oil to generate its own electricity, and it also imports some electricity from France. France is actually Europe's largest net electric exporter, and because France has the very large nuclear capacity that was built during the 1980s in response to the first energy crisis.
Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting about the statistics in France is that although only 78 or so percent of the electricity used in France is nuclear, France also exports the equivalent of about 6 nuclear power plants to its neighbors. So
I find that to be very interesting as well. It's quite marked, and I think it's because they have the large base of infrastructure. In other words, your natural gas is often used as a peaker power type facility. It's used during times of high demand, like on hot summer days, whereas nuclear is baseload, and unless it's in outage, it's always available.
Have you done any research about the current situation in Germany with regard to nuclear versus renewables and other sources?
Germany I've looked up the chart, and I've looked up recent news in Germany. There was an article on the internet from a few news sources that said Angela Merkel and some other people are having a summit in Germany. They are discussing energy. Unfortunately, Angela Merkel is in the Conservative Party trying to hold together a coalition with the SPD, which is closely allied with the anti-nuclear Green Party. And I call them Green Party in name only, because the anti-nuclear policy is not a green policy. But unfortunately, Angela Merkel is trying to hold this political coalition together, and she was not willing to renounce Germany's nuclear power phase-out policy. That Germany still has this policy officially, and so there is certainly no plans to construct any nuclear power plants in Germany, and the facilities that are present there are scheduled officially to be phased out in a number of years. It's not real soon. In other words, there's certainly time to change that, and I'm aware that the utilities that operate the facilities would like to extend their lives.
Yeah, and so would the industrial people in Germany would like to extend those lives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The folks that run factories and that need power 24/7. Absolutely. Because if you look at the chart of Germany's energy, Germany's energy is really not such a good situation. Even though it has been Germany's official policy to promote non-hydro renewable energy sources, if you look at the chart, the non-hydro renewables are quite a small percentage of Germany's total energy picture. Nuclear power is a constant amount because there has not been any expansion allowed. I think it's around 20% or so, somewhere more or less around there. Coal is quite a large percent of Germany's energy picture, and this is rather ironic in light of the fact that Germany has elected to have fairly strict emissions reduction goals to meet the Kyoto Protocol.
Yeah, one thing that I've always found interesting about Germany's Green Party is if you trace the strength of the Green Party by region, it turns out that the Green Party is strongest in those areas of Germany that mine coal.
That is interesting. I did not know that, and I would not be surprised. That is very interesting. And that is amazing. Another thing that I have read recently is that Germany actually, the German government subsidizes the coal industry. And it's really pretty ironic. That's kind of like saying that the Green Party is strongest in West Virginia. That's pretty ironic. In the place where the most carbon intensive fossil fuel that has the worst record for particulate releases, sulfur dioxide emissions, and other pollutants. That's pretty ironic. That's pretty amazing.
And green in name only.
Yeah, and Shane can tell you a little bit about the kind of coal that Germany tends to burn.
It's rather sulfur rich.
I think they burn that same brown dirt that Texas likes to burn.
Yeah, slightly flammable dirt, a.k.a. lignite.
Lignite, yeah.
Lignite has, on average, about 8 megajoules per kilo of energy content, and by comparison, most coal is up around 20 to 25, and most gasoline is around 40. So that's why I call it barely flammable dirt.
All right.
Yeah, I'm aware they also call it brown coal.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's the German term for it.
It's pretty nasty stuff in general, and if you have to move it very far, it quickly becomes uneconomical completely to burn it because the amount of transportation required to move it, there's an awful lot of waste left over.
Well, there's also there's an optimistic note to sound about Germany, and that's if you look at Germany's situation now and compare it with Sweden's situation a year ago or 2 years ago when it looked like the phase-out was continuing to roll forward, look how fast that turned around.
Yep. Oh, Sweden has a...
turn around very quickly in Germany as well. All they need to do is sit down and run the numbers and realize that they're going to run into what is called in aerospace engineering the coffin corner, where you no longer have room to maneuver, you no longer have energy, and you're going to fall out of the sky.
Yes, now Sweden is quite interesting. Public opinion in Sweden has turned markedly in favor of nuclear energy, and I tend to think that likely it has to do with public education regarding which fuels are connected with the greenhouse effect and which fuels are carbon-free and emissions-free.
Well, there's another way to change public opinion, and that has actually started to occur in Germany, and that is when the Russians cut off the gas supplies last winter. People quickly realized that depending on imported Russian natural gas may be a risky way to run a country.
That's right, yes, that happened last winter. Uh-huh, you're exactly right on that.
And if we have a similarly harsh winter this year, and if the Russians continue dictating energy policy in that kind of way, I can imagine that Germany may start thinking differently. It's a matter of enough pressure and enough facts coming to light about coal and the funding sources of the Green Party and the coalition that Angela Merkel is holding together.
I would certainly hope so, and I would really hope that there might be some goodwill efforts coming from perhaps France and the Scandinavian countries on this matter, from people who have, enough of a background to explain these charts, and they could do a sort of a little presentation, kind of to Germans, to let them know what is going on and let them know the basic arithmetic behind their situation, and let them know what they need to do if they want to have a reliable, good supply of electricity, and also meet environmental targets.
You don't even need a calculator with a square root button to do this kind of arithmetic.
Sometimes I think that Germany is holding out. They want to keep those coal plants operating just long enough to make them qualify for carbon emissions credits, and when they start shutting them down as they supply nuclear power, they're going to change the market. But that's just a dream of mine. Of course, the other reason that there's a lot of Germans who are getting a little antsy about the current policy is that Germany, in the form of ABB and Siemens, had a very strong nuclear export industry back in the day when nuclear power was in favor around the world. And they had a number of jobs dependent upon that export industry.
And let us not also forget that pebble bed reactor technology was originally developed in Germany.
We never fail to mention pebble beds if we can help it.
That's quite interesting, and I think you're right. I seem to remember this back in the 1970s or so. But yes, German engineering, I feel that German engineering is being hurt by these policies. And, of course, the country has a very strong history in engineering and in automation.
I'm a big fan of German engineering, being a driver of a Jetta TDI that gets about 47 miles to the gallon.
That's great. That's great. It so happens that I've actually gone with engineering from another country that I guess was on the wrong side in World War II. I have a Toyota Prius, and I'm getting about 52 to 53 miles a gallon, and she's doing very, very nicely.
Very good.
Yeah, I thought about getting a Jetta, and it looks like my window of opportunity to get one new is closing. From what I hear, the Volkswagen is closing down their American line of diesels because of emission standards.
Are they closing it down, or are they going to revise it with the clean diesel that's coming out?
The last I heard, they were going to close it down, but if they're taking clean diesel into account, and I'm sure that the VW diesel engines can handle that fuel just as easily as they can handle anything else, there may yet be hope, but we'll have to go and look it up.
I'm aware that diesels can get higher miles per gallon than gasoline-fueled vehicles. I also know that ethanol gets poorer miles per gallon than gasoline-fueled vehicles. However, I'm not a big fan of diesel because of the particulate emissions.
Well, there is a way that was pioneered in Germany to bring the particulate emissions of a diesel engine down without changing the engine at all. Change the type of diesel to a synthetic diesel that's made from, if in the long term we would go eventually to recycling water vapor and carbon dioxide from the air with nuclear electricity, and run it through a synfuel process and produce perfectly clear oil, diesel oil, that can burn with something like only 10 or 20% of the particulates off the top without any modifications to the engine, because there's no sulfur in it. It's basically hyper-refined diesel. And that's also the technology that's used with gas to liquids.
It's interesting, but I actually tend to favor more the concept of using electricity directly and using it for electrifying rail lines, and which is widely done, in fact, in Europe. France has the TGV, which is a high-speed electric train. And, of course, that's emissions-free. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They set a record for steel wheel rail transport with the Atlantique line of the TGV about 10 years ago. They sustained a speed of 190 miles an hour. And
that's
on
impressive.
A steel
yeah.
to steel.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they can push 200 miles an hour with that technology, and you can get from one side of France to the other in less than an hour or two. It's phenomenal.
Wow. Before we close for the show, would you like to hear some of my specimens?
Sure.
Okay, great. I'd love to show you a couple of them here. I brought a number of specimens. However, probably the most interesting on the counter are going to be uraninite specimens. And the specimen's about 1.5 inches wide by an inch. And I'm going to put the sound on. Can you hear that?
I heard it at the beginning, and then it cut off. Okay, I hear it now. So that's with a scintillation counter, right?
That's a scintillation counter. And I'm going to walk away from the specimen and give you an idea of what normal natural background sounds like now. So I've walked probably a good 40 feet away or so, and this is natural background. And I'm going to walk back to toward where the specimen is. And, of course, I can't show the dial of the meter on the radio. But you can hear by the sound. And, in fact, this specimen is a real good, strong specimen.
Is that meter that you're using calibrated for counts per minute? And if so, what's the difference in counts per minute between background in your house and the specimen?
Okay, it's actually calibrated in microrentgens per hour.
Okay.
And the specimen, I'm on the 5,000 scale, and I actually get about 4,500 microrentgens per hour if I put the specimen right up against the meter. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk away from the specimens to an area where there's should be nothing else other than a natural background. We change scales here. And my reading out here is just a little bit, just around 10 or 11, 12 microrentgens per hour.
Now, it's interesting.
So,
let me ask you a question, Ruth. From my...
I'm sorry?
Through my headphones, it actually sounds a little bit more intense in the background. And I guess that's because as you change scales, it changes the audible response also.
Yeah. Okay, the background sounds like this. And the specimen sounds like this.
Ah, now I get it.
And the audio shouldn't really change from me changing scales, but it might have to do with the position where I'm holding the phone. So that might have to do with it. Were you able to hear that?
Oh, we heard it pretty clearly, but it surely sounds like the audible is affected by your scale selection, because when you did it without changing scales, it was quite a steady and high-pitched response.
The pitch definitely changed between the
ranges. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah.
The specimen is visibly yellow if it's a uraninite specimen.
This specimen is interesting. Uraninite is actually a black mineral. However,
the specimen has
a coating of gummite on it, and the gummite is bright yellow and orange. So we have both black and yellow here. The internal core of the specimen is black, and then the outer coating is yellow and orange. And the specimen is quite dense, of course. It's got a specific gravity of around 7 or 8, you know, because it is uranium oxide. And I found a few of these sorts of specimens in my time digging at the mines. One thing I would love to do eventually is to be able to use the specimens to demonstrate to school kids and to other people that radiation is part of nature, that it occurs in nature. These specimens were collected in a very beautiful area, and that it's part of nature. That's all there is to it.
Hey, Ruth, I really want to thank you for coming on. You're a fascinating conversationalist. I appreciate all the discussion, and hope we'll have the opportunity to continue talking and exchanging ideas about energy, and particularly nuclear energy.
Well, thank you very much. I hope to do it again sometime. And also, if you guys are ever in the North Carolina area, I'd like you to look me up, and we can go out and do some mineral collecting.
Well, now that you mention it, how far are you from Franklin?
I am about perhaps 90 or 100 miles east of Franklin.
Okay, because Franklin is one of our common vacation areas. My mother has a house there.
Franklin is an area where you can collect ruby and corundum. But if you want to bring a counter down or borrow a ludlum, the place to come is 100 miles east of Franklin, because I don't know of any radioactive mineral occurrences in or around Franklin. The mineral deposits are rather different.
Well, for me, a 90-mile trip is no big deal. I drive 45 miles to work every day, so.
Okay.
All right. Good night, Shane.
Good night, all.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Ruth.
Good night, Ruth. Nice talking with you.
Atomic Insights.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Hello, everyone. I'm Joel Murphy from Hobo Radio. Just thought I'd tell you guys a little bit about our show. What are you doing? Dude, I'm trying to do the... What are you... I'm Joel Murphy, and you know what? Just forget it. I'm trying to...
Hobo Radio. Only on the Podcast Network.
You know, I'm out of here. Are you happy?